We're making the case against cynicism in this hour. And so what exactly does it mean to be cynical? Well, I looked it up. The dictionary definition is not trusting or respecting the goodness of other people. There's a lot of that going around, huh? Let's pick one example. White supremacy.
To be white is to be a striver, a crusader, an explorer, and a conqueror. We build, we produce, we go upward. And we recognize the central lie of American race relations. We don't exploit other groups. We don't gain anything from their presence. They need us and not the other way around. America was, until this past generation, a white country designed for ourselves and our posterity. It is our creation. It is our inheritance, and it belongs to us. Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
That's Richard Spencer. He is one of the most prominent white supremacists in America. He was one of the organizers of the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, which is in the news again right now, as this week marks the one-year anniversary. Richard Spencer helped bring white supremacy and white nationalism out of the shadows. But I want you to meet a man who knows this world well and who's trying to do something about it. His name is Christian Piccolini. He was recruited into a skinhead group when he was just 14 years old. He went on to lead the Hammerskin Nation, which is the most violent neo-Nazi group in America. And then he had a change of heart. He left the movement at age 22. He told Charles Monroe Cain he's dedicated his life to getting others out of extremist hate.
People are not born as extremists, and that ideology and dogma are not what are driving people to these movements. Whether we're talking about the American white supremacist movement or the European white supremacist movement or even ISIS or perhaps even street gangs, I believe that young people are looking for a sense of identity, community, and purpose. And if we hit enough of what I call potholes, those things in life that just deviate our path, and sometimes we can't find our way around them without the proper guidance or support. And I do believe that we are facing a crisis right now where we are letting our young people down. And in droves, they are looking for meaning, and oftentimes in very, very dark places.
Well, speaking of male leadership, you recently had an encounter with Richard Spencer. For listeners who don't know who Richard Spencer is, could you remind us who he is and tell us about your encounter with him?
Yeah, Richard Spencer is famously known as the Nazi who was punched by an Antifa member, or the person who said Hail Trump in D.C. after Trump won the election. And I think most people would recognize him as probably one of the most prominent faces and voices of this white supremacist movement in America today. And recently, in December of 2016, there was an incident in Whitefish, Montana. Most people don't know this, but he lives there about 50% of the time, while he lives another 50% of the time in Virginia. And Richard Spencer's mother was involved with a Jewish real estate agent, and they had a falling out. A white supremacist website called the Daily Stormer attacked the Jewish community, published their names, their photos, their phone numbers online. And they received thousands and thousands of death threats and a threat of an armed march in their town. And Richard Spencer was a part of this terror that came to this community. And I was asked by the community to come speak to them because they wanted to understand what was happening.
Okay.
So I decided I was going to do a little trolling myself. I tweeted to Richard Spencer and I said, hey, I'm in your hometown. In fact, I'm speaking about you tonight. If you're in town, you should stop by. And I certainly never expected him to respond. But he showed up, and nobody really knew he was there. He kind of walked in when it was dark and just before I was about to start. And after I finished my talk and finished the Q&A, the last question I received was, obviously, you're aware of Richard Spencer and the damage he's done to our community. What would you say to him if you were standing right in front of you right now? And I simply just turned to the balcony in the audience, and I spoke right to Richard, and I said, Richard, would you like to go out for a cup of coffee?
Hey, Richard.
So what do you think of the state of Israel?
Let's have some coffee. Let's talk. Sure.
Okay.
We met for 2 hours after that.
There's video of that, of course, and I've seen it. You kept staying on him.
I think you're lost like I was for 8 years, and I want to know what set you down that path.
I agree with you that I and so many people are lost in the 20th century, mm-hmm. in the sense that we're deracinated. We don't have roots, we don't have a sense of who we are, and they're searching for something deeper and something real.
I don't think you hate anybody. I think you, deep down inside, have something about yourself that you hate.
In every situation that I've worked in with somebody, there is a level of trauma that they are dealing with that they perhaps don't even really know about or have never kind of tackled head on. It could be one of the things that led them down this path.
I did have a deep concept that something was wrong, that there wasn't meaning in my life. I wasn't part of something bigger than myself. I don't have some deep resentment towards Africans. I have a higher ideal of what the right white race can be. And I actually have a superhuman ideal. I'm not caught up in, you know, justice or security or comfort. I think what I do this fundamentally is because we need to explore the universe. And only we can do it.
Hang on a second.
Yeah.
Why even engage someone like that?
First of all, I've heard everything that he's going to say. I used to say it. And in fact, many times what I hear coming from people's mouths are things that I helped construct back in the 80s.
Right.
So when Richard would try and feed me with propaganda or try and shift the conversation to one of ideology, I would simply ask him a simple question like how his relationship was with his daughter or what's his relationship like with his father. And I think I did shock him a little bit because he, first of all, isn't used to being asked questions like that and probably has never really thought about how to answer them.
And also,
I think that's a very human fundamental need. I mean, I would agree with you.
Also,
and I think
like,
you heard me even talk about that.
I am elitist in the sense that, like, I could have called it quits after I got punched.
He comes from extreme privilege. He's very isolated. I believe he's struggling with an identity crisis. I think that there are a lot of issues at play there.
The fact is, like, I had a burst eardrum. I had a concussion. Mm-hmm. I think it was fairly serious. And, you know, these people do want to kill me. They've come to my house. They talk about killing me, but I keep going,
right.
And I'm willing to die.
You know, most people like to think of these people who do these awful things as monsters,
mm-hmm.
And I was one of those people.
And you weren't a monster.
I wasn't a monster. I was a broken individual who was willing to do monstrous things to get attention. Most of the times, they're saying those things and they're blaming other people and they're wishing ill on the other because of things that happen in their lives, not necessarily perpetrated by those other people, but they're rationalizing their own pain, their own self-hatred, and they're projecting it onto other people to diminish their own pain.
Right.
If you just make somebody feel worse than you do, well, then of course you're better than them. Of
right.
course, at least you feel better than them.
I went down a path and like you, I was passionate. I was willing to die for it.
Mm-hmm.
I was willing to do what it took to make the vision come to a reality. I hope that someday you will realize that what you're doing is not only hurting other people, it's also hurting you. Like down the road, like you don't think that this is something that's a cancer building up inside of you? This anger, this fear, this rhetoric, this trolling even, the toll that it takes on other people is eventually going to take a toll on you.
At one point, you ask him if you can hug him.
Nice meeting you. Can I give you a hug?
Yeah, well, you know, I wanted him to know that if there was ever a voice in his head that caused some confusion, that I would be, a welcoming, friendly ear for him to vent to.
I really enjoyed talking to you. I do want to continue the conversation.
Yeah.
Someday you're going to mean that hug.
I did mean it.
So what, you're available now? He gives you a buzz once some 2 in the morning and says, oh my God, dude, I'm hurting. Like, I want to change. Help me out. Like, is that what you're there for him now?
You know, I think in theory, I am there for him for that. It hasn't happened yet.
No, I know that.
We've had a couple of conversations since then that have not turned out quite so well.
Sure.
He still is so intent on acting like a 4-year-old and calling people fat and traitors.
Sure.
You know, I take it, I listen to those things, and I hope that there's a moment someday where he realizes and takes a step back from this moment of fame that he's experiencing and says, you know, my God, I've set this world on a course that is destructive, just like I did, just like I realized one day.
Yeah.
It may happen, it may not happen, but I can guarantee you that there aren't a whole lot of people that are willing to give them that chance.
No, right.
And if there's nobody willing to give him that chance, the chances of him going down a better path are slim to none.
Let's talk about that for a second. Well, how do you do it? So say it's me, I want to leave extremism, and I'm an extremist. Like, what's the first thing you do with me?
The first thing that I want to do is build a rapport with you. Most of the people in these types of movements are very untrusting. They don't trust government. They don't trust the media. They don't trust outsiders or who they consider the enemy. And to many of them, I am the enemy. I'm a traitor.
Right.
So I really try and establish that rapport. And I do that by not being argumentative.
It seems so complicated, I guess, to get out of hate.
It is. It is very complicated, not only because there's hard work to do, but because there's such a stigma around having been involved in this and the belief that some people have that once you've done that, you can never change. That is the biggest struggle for most people when they decide to leave is, you know, will people, no matter what I do, still judge me for what I've done? And of course, there's a lot of hard work involved. There's a lot of amends that need to be made and accountability.
But you're not talking like generally making amends. You're saying, look, you did this to this family. You need to go to this actual family or this person and make amends that way?
Sure. I've done that myself. I mean, I've identified people that I've hurt in the past and found them to make amends with them. But there are so many people that I hurt that I didn't know who they were. I mean, one story that really kind of hits me the most, just several months ago, somebody showed me a post that Dylann Roof had made on a website called Stormfront, which is a very large white supremacist website. And he had asked for the name of a band who had written these lyrics that he had heard on some program. As I read these lyrics, I recognized that they were my lyrics. And this was 4 months.
Ugh.
Yeah, this was 4 months before he walked into the Mother Emanuel Church and slaughtered 9 people. And you know, I couldn't help but feel partly responsible for what had happened.
Yeah.
So I know even 30 years later, after the amends that I've made, I still know that I planted all these seeds of hate many, many years ago that I will forever pull the weeds from.
How do you know when if a skinhead that you work with falls off the wagon? What do you do about that?
That's a really good question. Part of how I do address the ideological component, I'll introduce haters to people that they think that they hate. I've spent dozens of hours with Holocaust survivors and Holocaust deniers and Islamophobes and Muslim families and homophobes and LGBTQ communities. Because once you've met somebody that you think that you hate, and you realize suddenly that that hate has come from a demonization and it's suddenly destroyed with humanization, it's really hard to walk back from that. But, you know, it is a lot like drugs. It is a lot like alcohol, where you have to make sure that you're critically thinking all the time and don't fall back into that pattern of blaming the other for no other reason other than to make yourself feel better.
You know, I have one last question for you, and I want to flip the switch here a little bit. You, for many years, saw minorities and gays and Jewish people as the other, the person that you hated. I think for a lot of my listeners, people listening right now, they see the kid with the swastika on his neck as the one to hate. Tell her, what should we do with that guy? Because he makes me mad he scares me.
Yeah, well, we should be scared because when people are lost in this ideology, myself included, we were capable of anything. I mean, there were times when I was very adamant about committing acts of violence and even mass acts of violence during that period. And what I can say is every single person in that movement, whether they are part of a group or a lone wolf or just indoctrinated online, has gotten to that point because they have felt marginalized or broken. And what I say is for people who are marginalized, we cannot continue to marginalize them further because that just pushes them further away.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not suggesting everybody hug a Nazi like I did with Richard Spencer, but we need to bring them in closer.
You know, I was thinking about your book, and I recently interviewed Arno Michaelis and some other people, and it seems like there was a cumulative effect of small acts of kindness. There wasn't some one moment in any of these stories where, like, oh, I'm not a Nazi anymore. It was these cumulative effects of compassion. And maybe I just need to, like, online or interactions with people just show small acts of compassion. So maybe I contributed 5 years later to this person changing.
That's a great point. I saw somebody do that recently, and Sarah Silverman had a troll attack her and call her a really vulgar word. She replied and said, "How can I help you? After looking at your Facebook page, I've noticed that you're depressed. I've noticed that you're struggling with lower back pain that you've never been able to rectify, and you don't seem like you have a lot of friends. What can I do for you, friend?" And after just a couple of Twitter conversations with this guy, he came around and the world really started to support this person who had been nasty, just a nasty, nasty troll. And suddenly this person had found this compassion and this empathy and started to embrace it and changed his views. And actually now Sarah is in an ongoing communication with this person and their friends, and she's trying to help him with an education and with a doctor, and it's completely changed his view. So I think that these small acts of kindness, these pay it forward compassion moments, are really the key to eliminating hate.
Thank you very much for the work that you do.
That's my pleasure, Charles. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Charles Monroe Kane talking with Christian Piccolini. Christian co-founded Life After Hate, a nonprofit group that helps former extremists change. And you can watch the video of that conversation he had with Richard Spencer on our website. It's at ttbook.org.